Had we but world enough and time, this coyness lady were no crime. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, nestled deep within the forest city of London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight, we started our show with the first two lines of Andrew Marvell's famous poem, To His Coy Mistress. Marvell's poem urges its readers to seize the day, for neither time nor space is infinite for us. But, like Marvell's mistress, the planets themselves have been reticent to give up their secrets easily. While the planets are amongst the brightest objects visible from the ground, even the most powerful telescope on the surface of the Earth does not possess the resolution to answer some of our most basic questions about how these eight objects came to be and are evolving today. And so, much about the planets remained a mystery until we could send out our spacecraft to look down upon other worlds from nearby and to touch their surfaces. The accompanying music tonight is Jupiter, from Gustav Holst's incomparable symphonic suite, The Planets, as performed in this case by the Australian Youth Orchestra. This well-known composition is a favorite of youth orchestras the world over, and I can still remember listening to it performed by the Newfoundland Symphony Youth Orchestra when I was younger. But the reason I chose an Australian interpretation was for our guest tonight and friend of the show, Paul Nalaney. Paul began his academic career in Australia and has been working his way east ever since. Since 1986, he's been a professor at York University and is currently the coordinator of the York Observatory. Recently, I had the opportunity to sit down with Paul in his Toronto office. Thank you for coming and speaking with us today, Paul. I'd like to start off by asking you to tell us a little bit about the York Observatory here at York University.
One of my favorite topics, John. Always happy to chat about the observatory. We have been around now actually for well over 40 years. When I think about that, that's actually a fairly stunning amount of time. We were commissioned, if you will, all the way back in the late 1960s when York was still a very new university. The Department of Physics was very young, and Dr. Rafe Nichols was in the process of trying to put in place the facility that would support both the undergraduate and graduate student populations here, as well as doing some outreach activities. So it goes back a long way. Arguably, however, we really began to do a lot of significant outreach activity in and around the mid-1980s. We dabbled with it throughout the 70s, and we've always had tour activity, summer public viewings, but starting around about 1986, 1987, we began to expand our offerings to include all year-round public viewing, a lot more activity as far as tour group activity is concerned, and all of this was growing up as interest in the observatory on campus was growing, and we began to employ a series of very enthusiastic, energetic undergraduate students. So the last 20 years, 25 years, I guess, has seen something of a renaissance, if I can use that term, for the York Observatory. The telescopes, portable observing facilities, all sky cameras. You know, we've built a whole series of new activities into what the observatory offers. So it's no longer just come along and look through our telescope, although that's still the primary undertaking, but there's a lot more to us these days.
So you're saying about 40 years old, so it would have been fairly rural when it was built, just like Cronin at the University of Western Ontario would have been sort of in the middle of nowhere.
And in some regards, I'd really like to go back to those days, but you can't turn back the hands of time in this regard. You're right. 40 years ago, York University was on the outskirts of Metro Toronto, and the skies around us were dark. The fields were still fields. People would grow crops here rather than build houses. And yeah, the skies, by all accounts, I wasn't here 40 years ago, but by all accounts, the skies were still relatively pristine. It was still quite dark. Definitely had a very rural feel to it, the entire campus. And when you look at some of the early photographs of the three and four buildings that represented the York campus, very famous photograph of our first president sitting at a desk in the middle of a field. Yes, we were a long way from anywhere, it seemed, in 1968.
One thing that stays constant, or I guess increases in popularity with outreach activities and things like that, as you get more and more of this urban light, is you get bright targets like the planets, which remain popular.
Absolutely. Just because the skies become poorer from an astronomical perspective doesn't mean that you can't still show the wonders of the universe to your visiting public. You just can't necessarily show as many faint objects as you would have once liked to. But generally speaking, when you're doing a public outreach activity with telescopes, rarely can you get past three or four objects for a group in any given evening. Your tour group normally musters 20, 30, or 40, sometimes as many as 100, to get through three or four objects on one telescope in a reasonable period of time is a bit of a challenge. You can only have one eye at the eyepiece at any given moment. Giving everybody the opportunity to look through the eyepiece for 30 seconds, even 60 seconds, it's a long time. 30 seconds for 40 people, that's 20 minutes an object. Three or four objects is normally the limit that you can get to. By the time you go through the moon, if it's up, one or two of the bright planets, and then one or two of the clusters or nebulae, you can't go much further than that. We have found that even though the skies have gotten poorer, from an outreach perspective, it really hasn't changed what we show the public. Arguably, the quality of what we're showing them has decreased. But again, the belts of Jupiter still shine through light pollution, the craters on the moon, and so on. You tailor your activity to your environment, and I think we've been very successful at going with the flow, shall we say, of the brightening skies of Metro Toronto.
Now, it's not just about outreach. There's also a research component to the work that's done at the observatory, isn't there?
Absolutely. From the perspective of our students, it's every bit as important that they know how to communicate science to the public as well as being able to generate good science for themselves. And to find out at an early age, if you will, early age as in 19, 20, 21 years, whether or not being up all night with the observatory or going through the frustrating aspects of data reduction, whether or not that is for them. So yes, our 60-centimeter telescope has been utilized now for the last 20 years or more very actively by our undergraduate students in a variable star program. We certainly did do research with the telescope prior to that. We've had many graduate students compile data and do their theses on information gathered at the observatory and elsewhere. So the last 40 or so years have seen a number of graduate-level activities on the telescopes. But again, from the mid-1980s, my emphasis was to engage the undergraduate student population. For one thing, of course, there's many, many more of them. They're very keen and enthusiastic, and trying to give them the taste of astronomical research early on was always a priority from my point of view. So variable stars, they're always doing something. They're very convenient in that regard, was the way to go from my point of view. Bringing the undergraduate students to the variable star projects on our 60-centimeter telescope, photometric variability using CCD cameras and so on, that has been a very successful undertaking. We've published a paper on average every 2 to 3 years from data collected by the students.
That's one of the nice things about photometry, is that it doesn't suffer so much from all of the stray light coming from the city. Now, you mentioned variable stars, but another photometric thing that I know is very sexy out there these days is exoplanets. Does any of that work get done here?
We've certainly used exoplanetary advances to tweak the excitement of our undergraduate students. We have a fourth-year course here in the physics department, which relies on a number of activities to give students very critical exposure to science. We give them a number of projects during the course of their 8 months. They have to not only collect the data, but then using IRAF and other tools, be able to analyze it very, very critically, and then put it together in the form of a paper for publication, which then gets marked. So it's a fairly high-profile project, and one of those projects in the last 3 or 4 years has been determining exoplanetary light curves, ingress and egress, and so on, of known exoplanets. We haven't actually engaged in a search pattern for exoplanets at this point in time, but knowing when certain exoplanets do their thing, shall we say, from a photometric point of view, has been utilized by our fourth year undergraduate class with great success. I mean, who would have thought 20 years ago that we would be using 60 centimeter caliber telescopes to find 1% dips in light curves and nailing exoplanetary orbits with it? It's to me one of the wonderful revolutions that has taken place over the last decade or two. So yes, we are using our facilities here at York and engaging our undergraduates in the search for exoplanets, but not so regularly as many of the other search programs around the world.
So mainly it's a training opportunity. Although I've got to ask, it's a 60 centimeter telescope. If we went back 1995 or even before, if you'd known what targets to look at, could you have actually seen these light curves?
Yep, absolutely. There is no doubt from the data that our students are currently collecting that we could have seen that type of an exoplanetary light curve back 20 years ago. Of course, would we have been looking for it was the bigger question to ask, and the answer is probably no. The other issue, of course, is that it's one thing to be able to say, yes, the telescope can find it, as in collect enough data and to be able to make the detection. Our telescope, though, is vintage 1960s. As a consequence, letting it talk to a computer system is often a bit of a challenge. It was conceived of and built long before the advent of personal computing systems. So the dome and the telescope often don't play nice together, so we've had to, you know, re-educate them about trying to keep out of each other's way. The telescope itself really does not have a computer interface. While we can obviously interface very easily with modern instruments, and we have forced the dome into some degree of acquiescence as far as please move out of the way, the telescope itself is not well suited to being driven around the sky on a regular basis. A lot of the programs that we would like to initiate, sort of the semi-automated observing programs, including for exoplanets, it's just not a very practical thing for this telescope. That said, I'm not bitterly disappointed. Having the students really learn how to observe from scratch, if you will, without as much reliance on computer techniques, I think is a good learning experience from their point of view. Once they've found their targets and once they've set up all of the aspects of an observing run, then it becomes sort of a little bit routine, almost mundane for 3 or 4 hours. So at that point in time, we have got enough automation, computerization on the system to let the students go home and study for their test the next morning while the telescope now collects data. But the process of setting up on a target for the evening is still very much a manual operation. And actually, I really make no apologies for that. I think it's good for the students to learn where things are in the night sky and to grapple with problems that invariably arise with equipment that's a little older and a little bit cranky, shall we say, on occasion.
Well, no doubt. There is no substitute for learning the sky, despite the existence of auto drive and stellarium and things of that nature. Now, in addition, I know that sometimes the observatory does more opportunistic things. I remember that we were on call for a while for the LCROSS impact on the moon.
Quite correct. LCROSS, the Venus transit, which occurred 8 years ago now, and of course, the next one that's coming up. Comets that sweep through the skies unexpectedly, especially if they make it to the Northern Hemisphere. You know, the Southern Hemisphere folks have had two really good comets in recent years, and it hasn't graced our horizons here. What's wrong with that? But yes, targets of opportunity, we're always alert to. I think everybody will remember the close approach of Mars, and I use the term fairly carefully, the close approach. Thousands, literally thousands of people turned up at the observatory over a five-night span to have a quick look at Mars at its prime. So yes, we are very flexible in that regard. If something is about to happen, the observing team and myself are ready to respond. And of course, those are the events which the public really likes. They get very engaged and very excited over it. So if we're not ready to meet that need, I don't think we're doing our job. The public has an expectation, and I think rightly so, that when targets of opportunity arise, we're there to show everybody the splendors of the universe.
Well, now you mentioned in there the Southern Hemisphere being fairly lucky in terms of comets lately, and you just recently got back from a sabbatical in Australia. I know that planetary science is something that's, we're on the increase here in Canada, as exhibited by the radio show you're listening to now and the one that comes directly before it. How are things doing down there?
Australia has always been a very fertile ground for astronomers, both amateurs and professional. Let's face it, Australia has large, large areas of nobody living there. So dark skies still can be found in Australia, not very far from the major urban centres. Now, of course, not very far if you're in Sydney is perhaps not a very accurate statement because it's, you know, Sydney's a big place. But nonetheless, that type of atmosphere, dark skies, has promoted very, very strong amateur astronomy groups. They don't have the equivalent of Canada's RASC, the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. Rather, it is a much looser coalition, but they get together on a regular basis. I was at the Astronomical Society of South Australia's meeting in September. Very, very full house of people listening to a couple of presentations. In fact, one of them was from a high school student who had just completed doing an exoplanetary transit operation for his grade 12 science project. And the Astronomical Society and the University of Adelaide had both teamed up to support this student. But he had done all the work with a 12-inch telescope in an urban centre. Adelaide, South Australia is about 1 million people. So it just shows you that we've come a long way on that particular point. Amateur astronomy, I think, has fueled the interest and the raw material, if you will, for the professional astronomers. Stromlo Observatory, Siding Spring Observatory, the University of New South Wales. You go round Australia, and over the last 30 years, it has had a very significant upswing in astronomical activities at universities. It's always been known for radio astronomy, of course, and again, radio quiet areas, but the observational astronomy, optical astronomy, has really increased a lot. I say that with some degree of sadness because, of course, when I was finishing off my university back 40 years ago, the opportunities in Australia for optical astronomy were only just beginning, and that's one of the reasons that, in fact, I came to North America. Never quite went home again. Sorry, Mum. But it was all of those activities in Australia that were growing in the 70s, but they really didn't come to fruition until in the 80s. And now, of course, just about every university in Australia has a very significant research component in astronomy and astrophysics. So, yeah, the place is booming, and what a wonderful place to observe from the Southern Hemisphere and Australia in particular.
Well, I know what you mean with going to another country. I remember back in 2003 when I was looking to do my doctoral work, there just wasn't anything in terms of planetary here in Canada, and so I went to the United States. Now I've been able to come back because there have been a lot of people who have sort of grown the field here. And it's interesting that you mentioned Australia is growing. It seems to have just about all the components that you would want for a planetary program. When you look at places like Arizona, for instance, you've got the geology right there, you've got great clear skies for observing, and you've got the technology aspect as well. Of course, we've got one of the major 70-meter dishes for NASA's Deep Space Network is located in Australia.
Tibdinbilla Tracking Station, just outside of Canberra. Yep, absolutely. In fact, it's interesting that you mentioned that particular location because I was just talking the other day with somebody about the fact that that was the dish that locked onto the Viking lander's first signal from Mars back in July of 1976. And I was an undergraduate at Canberra at that point in time. It was very, very exciting. The Tibdinbilla Tracking Station just down the road. But all across Australia, known for craters, some of the oldest rocks on the planet, fossils. I mean, there is so much raw material available to Australia that it was only natural that it would grow into being a significant player in the astronomy, astrophysics, planetary fields.
Indeed, and it continues to have a role. That dish is one of the three 70-meter, the other being in Spain and in California.
Radio astronomy in Australia, the Parkes dish, of course, made famous because of its role with respect to Apollo 11 and so on. There are just so many terrific facilities in Australia across the spectrum that it's just a great place to go down and visit. And if you can get your foot in the door there, you probably will never leave.
It sounds like it'd be an interesting place to go and work. Now, speaking of all of these arid locations with various astronomical observational facilities, I understand from your history that you worked a little bit at Kitt Peak near Tucson.
Yes, before I made it up to York University, and this is all the way back in 1985, I was at McGraw-Hill Observatory, which is at Kitt Peak, but sort of just down the road, shall we say, from the main facilities. The McGraw-Hill facility was a consortium of three universities, Dartmouth College, the University of Michigan, and MIT, and they together had a 1.3-meter and a 2.4 DFM telescope. In fact, it was one of the first DFM telescopes, a friction mount rather than sort of wheels and cogs and gears and so on. Very interesting telescope being put together there. So I was one of the astronomers there who was helping commission the 2.4-meter telescope. That was my introduction to Arizona for about 18 months. Nice skies, that's for sure. Terrific lightning storms in the summertime, and I'm not a big fan of lightning, but yeah, a terrific place to observe. And of course, interestingly enough, at that moment in history, Kitt Peak was not so much into outreach activities. There were no tours of the facility, certainly not at night. There were some, I believe, during the day, but they were a little reluctant, if you will, at that moment in time. But since then, of course, they have opened up the entire arena, and now amateur astronomers as well as tour groups, even in the evening, are welcome at Kitt Peak. So they've recognized the importance of public outreach, of bringing the public closer to astronomical research, and give everybody a bit of a sense and a bit of a taste of what it is that we enjoy doing. But yeah, I remember my 18 months at McGraw-Hill very, very fondly, and Kitt Peak was a wonderful place to be, a nice location about an hour outside of Tucson. You know, my only complaint was that you had to catch a bus at 6:15 in the morning. The Bluebird special. That was never a real good time of day as far as I was concerned. I did have the notoriety for being the person who could fall asleep quickest on the bus, though. So it's a very, very important trait to have.
I can imagine that that's useful for an astronomer, just trying to get a little bit of extra shut-eye whenever you can.
That's right. Cap naps here and there, just take the opportunity. Very comfortable bus, and I was often asleep before we pulled out of the parking lot.
So you mentioned the Kitt Peak has now gotten into the outreach game, and York Observatory has been in the outreach game for quite a long time. Still, we're talking 20, 30 years. What's really behind this upswing in outreach activities for astronomy?
I would like to argue that it's because we have recognized the importance of having good public relations. We as astronomers are engaged in, when all is said and done, a fairly research-oriented engagement, which doesn't necessarily have frying pans to show people with Teflon coatings or, you know, silicon chips that end up driving personal computers. A lot of what we do and love to do has a far more intellectual engagement. The search for life on other planets has profound philosophical impacts and so on. Trying to unravel the mysteries of the universe, it excites us, but it doesn't necessarily have a great impact to the public on a day-to-day basis. As a consequence, if we wish to have the support of the public, and that means really their tax dollars, then it's important that we show them what we're doing, and we try to give them, the public, a measure of the excitement that we feel on a daily or nightly basis. Astronomy is one of those things that everybody can engage in their backyard. You don't need to have a telescope to look at shooting stars and meteor showers, to watch eclipses and so on. But to get the full measure of what those events are doing for the public, they need a little bit of insight, a little bit of background. And that's where my observing team and professional astronomers alike really come together, and we give that insight into why it is that shooting stars are what they are. Are we really in danger from being hit by a very large object that, say, took out the dinosaurs, the ozone layer, and the upswing of activity from the sun? How do all these things play together? Should we be concerned about auroras? Yeah, the public has a lot of interest in astronomy, and I think for a very modest investment of our time and energy, communicating what the answers are to some of their questions, as well as giving them insight into what we're doing, I think that just all plays to everybody's benefit. We continue to do what we love, the public gets some insight into what we're doing, and ultimately everybody wins, because, you know, some of those taxpayers' dollars come towards us without a whole lot of angst and a whole lot of grief. So I think you put all of it together and it just is a self-satisfying activity for everybody involved, both those of us who are giving the information as well as those who are receiving it, and the funding will continue.
I think that's certainly true, and it couldn't be more true for planetary as well, and space exploration in general. Let me ask you one more question, Paul. What's next for the York Observatory?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, 2 years ago, I didn't actually realize we were about to enter the radio realm, so as to speak. One of our observing students, Ted Ruddick, tripped over astronomy.fm, and before we knew it, we had our own radio show, The York Universe Now. It used to be called Live from York U. That was something I didn't see at all, and it's been a terrifically successful engagement for both our students as well as the listening public. And astronomy.fm has gone from strength to strength, again suggesting that the public really do like everything astronomical. So where will the university's observatory go next? I honestly don't know. We continue to do what I think we're very good at, and that is engage the public and utilize the telescopes as much as we possibly can, but always alert to other opportunities. That's one great advantage that I think the observatory has. It's not just me driving the process forward. We have all students, all of these undergraduate students and graduate students who keep coming up with ideas. You know, can we build our own planetarium inside the domes? Is another engagement where a few of them are trying very hard to put together the elements which will give us activity on a cloudy night, shall we say, without spending $100,000, which I don't have. Every time students come up with an idea, we air it and we see whether or not we can run with it. So what comes next for the observatory will undoubtedly be led by our students, and I'm more than happy to give them their opportunity to take us forward in whatever direction they want to do. I honestly don't know, but I'll be right there and enjoying myself as we march forward over the next 10 years or more.
It sounds like a bright future. Thanks very much for speaking with me.
Happy to be here, and good luck with this new venture of yours.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we've all listened to Paul's interview, and I guess my first question is for Alyssa, who's here. We'll get to Raymond later. All three of us are here at the roundtable today. Alyssa, this education public outreach aspect, especially with observatories, really seems to be on the upswing now. Of course, we're not an observatory here, but we have a similar commitment, don't we?
Well, yeah, for the CPSX, we have quite a large outreach program. To me, it's really important for universities to have that kind of connection with the community and with schools, either locally or in the surrounding area. We get a lot of support and funding from these areas, and I think we really need to show them how interesting our research is and how important it is. One of my reasons for doing outreach is actually to get the scientific literacy level of the public up. It's kind of an issue right now where you're having all these media articles and things in the news that come out with very little information or incorrect information, and it's really important that we can teach people how to think critically about these kinds of things. So that's just kind of why we should do outreach in a general sense. Now, planetary science is a really great way to do outreach for science to either kids or the public, because it hits on every single type of science there is, but it has the hook that it's in space. Everyone loves space. Everyone loves space and dinosaurs, right? So if you put a dinosaur in space, that'd be awesome, but we can't do that. So we're going to start with space. And every kid, every person has ever looked up into the sky and say, you know, yes, what's going on up there? What's out there? What's that? What's this? So it's a great hook. But then in planetary science, you could talk about geology. But maybe you're talking about geology on Venus. Or maybe you're talking about chemistry on Saturn. That kind of thing. So it's a really great way to kind of combine all the sciences. And what York University is doing with their observatory is really fantastic, because even though they're in the middle of Toronto, they're still able to do a lot of outreach, which is really important. And they're using kind of what they have to do a lot of important and interesting things.
It's true. And one of the great things with that observatory is even though it's in Toronto, you can still see the planets because they're such bright targets. Now, you mentioned dinosaurs and and space. We do, I guess, have kind of a combination of that. One of the big things here at CPSX is our astrobiology program.
Right.
And so maybe not dinosaurs, but maybe things that came before dinosaurs?
Right. So that's a very exciting topic for a lot of people, is the search for life on Mars or other bodies in the solar system or outside of our solar system. And that is definitely a hook, too. And getting people to realize how important that is. And maybe that's the reason behind some of the missions that are going out to Mars, for example. And that's really one of the reasons why we're so interested in that planet. Not just because it's quote-unquote easy to get to or whatever, but because it's very Earth-like and there's a possibility because we know that there's frozen water on Mars that maybe there was life there in the past.
That's true. It's one of the most accessible places, but one of the most Earth-like places as well, so it gives us a good place to learn a little bit about our own planet. And speaking of frozen water, I know they certainly get some of that from time to time in the observatory at York. We are located in Canada. Paul talked a little bit about how some of these machines dating from the 60s, they can be a little bit fussy. But he thinks it is good to have a hands-on approach, and I agree entirely. I mean, we have something similar here, don't we, Raymond, in terms of the technological aspect of going out to these places. I mean, you're yourself an engineer.
Yeah, and, you know, if you are, you know, we have the same thing with engineering students. He's talking about astronomy students who they're used to looking at data and spectrum graphs and things like this. But to actually go work with the telescope and to see just how hard it is to get what you want and how if you misaim it by a quarter of a degree, too bad for you. This is a challenge, and having an appreciation of that from an early age, as he says, you know, undergrad type age, is of great value in appreciating how the data is generated and what kind of errors and things can be in it. And we have the same problem with engineering students where, you know, they take courses in their undergrad that teach them very idealized models of how to understand systems that they're working with. But when you actually go and implement them, there are a lot of challenges that you may not anticipate. In fact, I was recently doing an outreach activity in which I presented the idea of a rover going to Mars. And one of the students put up his hand and says, "Why are you sending a $2 billion robot? Can't you just send like a remote control car with a camera on it?" And I said, "That's what that is, but it's this hard to do." By the end of the robot workshop we were doing, he had some appreciation for how hard it is to make robots work for real. But it certainly is something that's very useful to understand the difference between theory and practice and to actually get your hands on some hardware.
And that really meshes well with Alyssa's idea of sort of education and public outreach producing more of a science-educated citizenry. Because what we do here, it actually is something that technically needs to get done. It's not magic, even though sometimes we may gloss over the 5 nights you were up till 12:45 in the morning just to get this data out that, and at the end, all you have is one pretty picture for the press.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's a sort of a spectrum there, right? I mean, we do education and public outreach programs, so-called, where we talk to the public, and we talk often, the target is young people, children, high school students. And so here are some people who are not specialized in, for example, astronomy, who are learning a little bit about it. And then some of them will perhaps become astronomy undergrads. And there, they need to know a little bit more. And they need not just to know the theory of how stars are forming and what their spectra look like, but also the instruments that you have to use. And then you get more specialized and more specialized, but nonetheless, you still need to be plugged in a bit to the rest of the community. And it's not enough to only know one little microscopic slice of the knowledge pie. You need to have some appreciation of what's going on around you. And so sometimes we have to do a little bit of inreach to go with the outreach and work on our own community, be it our own students or our own colleagues, to make sure there's some sort of cross-feeding.
That's true. And it's also kind of about building excitement, too, isn't it? We really want to get these people interested, get them fired up, and maybe they'll consider a career in what we do or follow the work that we do.
Well, that's right. You know, Alyssa talks about the importance of scientific literacy among the public. But I think it's also valuable just to present to the public and say, look at this. We're working on robots and spaceships and laser beams and missions to other worlds. And isn't that really cool? Because it is. And it's the real world. You can go later and play a video game about robots, but these are real. And they're on Mars. There's something pretty exciting about that. And as you say, space has some kind of lasting appeal. It really does get people excited. So it's an effective tool for outreach, for sure.
And what's nice is that you're tying outreach and inreach together, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know Paul mentioned he gives opportunities to undergraduate and graduate students to help with their outreach programs. Those students are gaining the skills of being able to communicate with the public, and it just kind of is a snowball effect, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's all well and good if you're really good at your research, but if you can't tell anyone what you do in an understandable way, no one's going to care.
Yeah.
And so if you can go out and you've learned how to communicate your science properly, people are going to be more excited about it.
Well, exactly. And we're making better researchers out of those people. Because if you cannot explain your research to someone who doesn't already know it, you're not of much use.
Right.
And the ability to explain astronomy or engineering to someone who doesn't know anything about it, this is the job of a first-year professor. building up this competence in what we call scientific interpretation, science communication, if you will. This is an important skill for a scientist to have, or anybody who works in this kind of field.
And I guess at a fundamental level as well, most of us who do work in universities are doing work that is paid for by the public ultimately. It comes out of the public purse. And so it really is a duty for us to sort of give back and share with them why it is that what we're doing is exciting, why it's important, and why they might want to continue to fund us to do and learn these things that we then share with them.
Right. I mean, often when I go and do these outreach events and we're talking about space exploration, a lot of the time get the question of why are we wasting the money on this, mm-hmm. is how they phrase it. And to really try to convince them, look, there are all these spin-off technologies, and all those spin-off technologies create other jobs, and really the percentage of the budget that NASA has of the total mm-hmm. American budget isn't very big. But when they hear a price tag of X number of billions of dollars, it doesn't matter if the United States is spending trillions. It's such an astronomical number to them, they don't understand. So to try to get them to understand the importance of it and what else could spin off from it.
Yeah, and I'm not the first one to say this, of course, but it's true that, you know, maybe NASA has a budget of $15 billion, but they have never spent one of those dollars in space.
That's right.
Right?
All those dollars are spent on right here on Earth.
It drives the terrestrial economy, and there are things that we do in space that enable the economy. You know, planetary exploration is a bit of a stretch, aside from the industry that builds that stuff, and the spin-off of things like instruments to be used for other things.
True. You need that pioneering originally.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Exactly. Someone has to start. But certainly a lot of the things that are done in space have direct use. A lot of the Earth observation, the telecommunications, the navigation systems. Without these, the whole industry of GPS navigation systems in your car and smartphones wouldn't be there.
And of course, we use those technologies even in things like the analog work that we do here.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got past space technology feeding into lessons learned to help develop future space technology.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are certainly things that you end up finding to be of value. If you want to send humans to explore another planet, there are a lot of things you're going to have to do, like learn how to recycle resources, be it water and food and things like that. And to make use of that on Earth, you don't have to look any farther than remote communities and developing communities for applications of these technologies. So the case can be made, but it's through outreach that we actually get people to be aware of these things.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host John Moores. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and John Moores. Our editors were John Moores and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. Or you can follow us on Twitter at WWAFM or on Facebook, where we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.